pleasure to introduce our main speaker, Sheldon F. from Las Vegas.
Everybody, my name is Sheldon Fetty. I'm an alcoholic. It is a great pleasure to be asked to speak at my home group. I have the privilege in Alcoholics Anonymous to get to talk from time to time, but speaking here in front of people that watched me and helped me get sober and people that I know quite well is, I am more nervous tonight than I have been ever at a podium. They say that the way to make an average speaker a great speaker is to put him on an airplane and fly him to a town in which he doesn't live. So you're in store for an average speaker tonight. I tell you a little bit about myself. I was born in the north of England in a city called Leeds. It's about 200 miles straight north of London. And I was born to average parents in an average home. My parents were not alcoholic. My dad, to this day, I think I've seen him drink twice, and my mom is not a drinker either. So if coming from an alcoholic home is somehow a prerequisite to being an alcoholic, I don't qualify on that level. But my childhood wasn't an easy one. I know you feel terrible for me. My parents divorced when I was very, very young. I was 2 years old when my dad left, and my life turned upside down. I don't remember things about my childhood that my brother remembers. I don't remember living in a nice house and being from a nice family. I remember living in England's equivalent of Section 8 housing and being brought up by a welfare mom, and I hated my dad and I hated my mom, and we're Jewish, and we moved from a Jewish neighborhood to a non-Jewish neighborhood. And in England, there was a lot of anti-Semitism when I was growing up. People were still in a lot of pain from the Second World War, and everybody had someone in their family that died trying to save them Jews, and they wanted to take it out on me, and I didn't like it at all. And growing up, I hated my childhood, and by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, if you would have asked me, I would have told you that that was exactly why I drank. And if you had lived the way that I lived, and if you had grown up the way that I grew up and had the family that I had, you would have drank too. And I get to Alcoholics Anonymous and quickly figure out what my first resentment's going to be. And that is that there are people in this world, in Alcoholics Anonymous, that had the childhood that I imagined if I would have had, it would have been perfect. You know, my wife, now, some of you know my wife, and I know you're not supposed to pronounce someone an alcoholic, right? It's kind of against the rules. But I think I'm safe in saying that my wife is an alcoholic, you know. But she grew up in a family where the parents were married long after she moved out of the home, and they lived in Cape Cod in a big house, and they had the maids, and Dad had a boat and a plane, right? And how can someone be an alcoholic that grows up in that kind of an environment, you know? I also have learned since that there are people in this world that had childhoods far worse than mine, that are not alcoholics. Now, if you had a childhood worse than mine, I don't mean to minimize the effect of your childhood on you. I don't really. But there are people that are not alcoholics that were beaten with extension cords and had cigarettes and cigars put out on them, and they were shoved in closets and starved and abused in ways that I could only imagine, and they would just be, you know, and these people are not alcoholic. You know what the worst thing was about my childhood, really? The worst thing about it? It happened to me. And if you were to come to me now and say, Sheldon, I had this terrible childhood and this was what it was like, I'd tell you, get over it, kid, you know. Suck it up. Write an inventory. I don't care. Go help someone, you know. No big deal, punky, you know. But I get here tortured by this stuff, you know. I remember my first drink, and I don't think that really makes me an alcoholic. It's interesting that I remember my first drink. I like drinking, and maybe that's why I remember my first drink, but you can take one look at me, and you can see that I like Snickers bars. You're probably thinking to yourself, I bet he does, you know? But But I don't remember my first Snickers bar, you know? It stands to reason that there was Snickers bar one, right? But it just does, right? But I don't remember it for the life of me. I just don't. I was 9 years old when I had my first drink. I was with a kid called Barry Durham, and he was a guy that was 2 years older than me, and I would have done anything he wanted me to do because I wanted to hang out with him. He was kind of cool, and I was kind of awkward, and he said, hey, let's get together, and we'll put our little bit of money that we've got, the little pocket money that we have together, and we'll go stand in front of this liquor store till somebody is willing to go in and buy us a bottle. And I don't know what we're going to do or what it's for, but I'm going along with Barry because I want to be Barry's friend. We stand in front of a liquor store and somebody goes in and buys us a bottle of Old English apple cider. It's apple juice with a kick is all this stuff is, right? And I went to this, we were in a liquor store, went to the wooded area behind the liquor store, and we drank this Old English apple cider. And something happened to me that was going to happen almost every time that I drank. I puked out of my nose. Because I'm not a good drinker. You know, there are guys in AA that like, you know, I could have 15 beers and drive better than I can sober. I'm not that guy. I'm going to wet myself, fall over, break something, embarrass myself. I'm not a good drinker. It's really hard to believe that I would do something that desperately that I'm not very good at. But I wasn't very good at drinking. But something else happened, and I've heard it described from the podium in a thousand ways by a thousand different speakers. And what happened to me was I'm this short, fat Jewish kid with a big nose whose parents are divorced. And I take this hit of this Old English apple cider, and nothing really happens, but emotionally, all that stuff that's knotted up inside of me, all that stuff that I don't really know is wrong with me because I have no reference point of not feeling that way. But I take that drink, and it goes inside me, and it feels like my parents get remarried. It feels like I grow 6 inches. It feels like I get a nose job. It feels like I lose 50 pounds. It feels like my foreskin grows back. I'm just trying to make sure you're listening. You know, I'm trying to make sure that we're keeping up with each other. You know? But seriously, what happens is that for the first time in a long time, I feel okay, is really what happens. All the joking aside, what really happens is for the first time, I feel like I'm okay. And I make this, I'm going to do this again. And at 9 years old, when you live in my mom's house and you decide you're going to drink every opportunity you can, it's maybe once more that year, and twice the next year, and five times the next year. And by the time I'm 16, I'm drinking a couple of three times a week whenever I can, and I've started to find drugs. And I don't want to upset anybody by talking about drugs. I only have one thing to offer. I have my experience, my strength, and my hope. I have my story. And I don't think it would be fair or right of me to come to Alcoholics Anonymous and change my story to make anybody happy. So I'm going to tell my story. I got involved in drugs because they never asked me for ID when I was buying them. You know? Nobody ever said to me, sorry, Slim, you don't look like you're old enough to buy this stuff, right? So it was easier for me to buy it, and I was better at it than I was drinking. I was better at it, and I loved it. And I was 16 years old, and I left my mom's house, and I left England, and I moved to Southern California to live with my dad, and I was terrified. Because in England, they got this goofy rule where they don't have photographs on IDs. I think they do now, but they didn't 20-some years ago. So it was easy for you to buy stuff and do whatever you wanted to. I got to be 21 to drink in California. I'm 16, and you're going to ask me to prove it, and I think my life is over. And something happened to me in California that my mom says to me 20 years later, 15 years later, when I say, Mom, can I come live with you because my life's falling apart, and I want to come live with you because I think my life would be better in Chicago where you live. And she says, Sheldon, you can come if you like, but water always finds its own level. And she's right. I have a natural knack for going to a new town and finding the people that do the things that I like to do. I got this radar, and I was able to get to California and plug in real quickly. And I love drinking, and I love partying. I tell you, I did it every opportunity I could. I did it most days, and I really, really liked it. I heard somebody say from a podium, I've heard other people say it in open discussion meetings, that their very, very best day drinking was not as good as their worst day sober. And I'm thinking, what were you drinking? Because I've had some times when I was partying, boy, that were just, I got this one emotional memory, and maybe you've got some memories of your partying. I got this one where we were at Shoreline Amphitheater in San Jose, Santa Cruz, and the Grateful Dead were playing. And I love going to Dead shows. And I'm up at the back. It's real steep in that arena. And I'm way at the back of the arena. And I'm four hits of window pane. And the band's playing. And there's these clouds and this lightning. And it was like that thick fog where it's not raining, but if you move your hand real quick, you kind of get wet, you know, that they get in that area. And I'm loving it. And lightning goes off. And Jerry screams out, "It looks like rain!" And the crowd goes insane. And I have a spiritual experience right then and there, the likes of which that no 12-step call has ever given me. It was magical. Man, if it was still like that, I'd be still going hard at it because I love it. It was just cool. I love drinking. I love partying. And I just dig it, man. I dig it. I'm that guy that 19, 20 years old is saying to people, you know, I could quit if I wanted to. I just don't want to. And why would you? Because if it works like that, if you're here on a court card and it still works like that, phew, keep going, pal, because if you get to the end of the road and you found out you had a couple of good years left in you, that would be a shame, wouldn't it? I mean, that would be a goddamn crime. I mean, don't stop till you run out of steam, boy, because I loved it. It was really cool. It was really cool. I'm 24 years old, and I start getting in trouble, though. I start having problems like that I can't handle. My life starts to become unmanageable to me. I can't imagine living the way I'm living. I get really lucky, and I end up on TV. I end up being a national spokesperson for a company, and I'm doing QVC and Home Shopping Network, and I have some infomercials that are running, and I'm traveling the country like a big shot, and I've got corporate credit cards in my wallet, and I'm 23, 24 years old, and I'm the young guy and a bunch of old executives, and they're respecting me, and everything seems to be going well. And I'm traveling on the road for this company, and I get back in the hotel, and I should be on top of the world. But I'm sad. And I don't know why I'm sad. And I'm depressed. And I don't know why I'm depressed. I can't put my finger on what's wrong. Life should be okay. And I'm throwing drinks at it. And I'm throwing dope at it. And I'm telling you, I'm getting drunk and I'm getting high. But I'm not. I had this friend I used to party with that used to say, "Sheldon, I'm not going to do it unless we got enough, because you can't fly on one wing." Right? And I got three pairs of wings, boy, but I can't fly no more. And I'm in these hotel rooms, and I start to think that, you know, occasionally the idea of killing myself pops in my head, and it starts to be something that I'm considering as a viable way for my future to unfold. And I lose that job, and I lost that job because I was convinced, because this guy Bernard didn't like short, fat Jewish Englishmen, you know. On my paperwork when they let me go, it said something about not wanting a crack addict as their national spokesperson. But, you know, it seemed unreasonable to me at the time, you know. And I get another good job, and I lose that good job, and I get another good job, and I lose that good job. And I'm 26 years old, and I go to my dad's house, and I'm not allowed in my dad's house no more. I'm allowed in the driveway. I'm not allowed in his house. And I'm not a driveway guy. I'm not. I'm the family star. Hey, here comes Sheldon, the guy with a good job. I'm that guy. And now I'm not allowed in the house. I'm only allowed in the driveway because I've done a lot of goofy stuff that's caused them to not want me in their home anymore. And it's broken my dad's heart. And I always tell people that I ain't hurting nobody but me. But my dad's crying with a broken heart because his son is dying in front of him, and he's not allowed to let him in the house because he's almost ruined his marriage, the help he's tried to give me, but I don't care. I think my dad abandoned me when I was 2, and he's going to abandon me again when I'm 26, and I hated him then, and I hate him now, and you're going to leave me on the street one more time, and you know what? Screw you. Screw you. And I go stay at a friend's house. That's the only friend I got left in the world, and I'm 26 years old, and I got all this promise. I'm the kid with all the potential. I spilled it all on barroom floors and back alleys and making dope deals in my car. The glass of potential now is empty, and I got nowhere to go and no one to talk to but one friend left in the world, and I go stay with him and his wife and their kid. And they let me in their house, and you'd think I'd be grateful, wouldn't you? You should be grateful. I was grateful, except for the time when he came home. He wasn't like me. He was one of those guys that could have a couple and cut it off, you know. And he comes home one night, and he's got a 12-pack of beer and a little bit of white powder. And he gives me 2 or 3 beers. He has 2 or 3 beers. We do a little bit of white powder. He takes the rest of the powder, the rest of it, but he goes to bed. Now, chemically, I'm as awake as he's awake. Chemically, there's no reason if he can sleep why I can't sleep, but I can't sleep. Because I lay down in bed, and my head starts talking to me. Sheldon, there's more. Did you know there's more? There's more. He's got more. There's more. You know there's some left. He's got more. And then the house is kind of old, and it settles a little bit. It creaks, right? And I think I know what that is. He's creeping across the bedroom floor to do more without me, laughing, right? I know. 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock in the morning, he leaves the house, he's in construction. His kid, who was 15, was the captain of the surf team for Dana Point High. That's a cool deal, man. That's better than being football captain, boy, in Dana Point. He's captain of the surf team for Dana Point High, and his wife's got a good job, and they all leave the house. And I can't stop myself. I ransack his room. I find his stuff. And for those of you, I don't take it all. I'm not stupid, right? I take a little less than half. You can get away with a little less than half. I went back 3 times. Now, if you've never done any dope, let me give you some dope math, okay? A little less than half times 3 is a little more than none. He comes home and he says to me, Sheldon, did you take my stash? I said, no. Wasn't me. I think I saw your son in there. I'm sorry, I'm at the wrong meeting. This must be the PTA. Ooh, I must have made a wrong turn on 6th Street. Ooh, you know, I'm not a thief. I'm really not, and I'm not a liar, and I'm not a cheat. You might be, I'm not. I'm a pretty good guy, but I'm a survivor. I'm a survivor. I'll do what it takes, when it takes to get what I need to get by, because there's something going on inside of me that I can't stop or control. But I didn't say to him, I think it was your son. What I probably said was, I don't know, man. It was me. I think it was your son. Because he didn't buy it, and he threw me out, and now I got nowhere to go. And I'm back at my dad's house, and my dad, with tears in his eyes and a broken heart, who doesn't want to watch his baby boy die, says to me, Sheldon, here's my credit card. Here's my credit card. You go get yourself a little hotel room somewhere. We'll deal with this in the morning. I don't know if anybody here is a member of Al-Anon. Al-Anon saved my mom and gave me my mommy back, and what a great deal Al-Anon is. My dad, thankfully, had never found Al-Anon, and he didn't know that giving me the credit card was a bad idea. So I take his credit card, and I check into a hotel in Sunset Beach with a view, and start getting drunk, and something happened to me in that room. Something happened to me that hadn't happened to me forever. I saw myself in the mirror, and it wasn't seeing myself in the mirror how we look at ourselves in the mirror, but it was seeing myself in the mirror. My eyes met my eyes, and I got to see what had become of me. And I tell you, it wasn't pretty. I'd become a user of people and a taker of things. I'd broken every heart that had come near me and hurt everybody that would let me hurt them. And I didn't like what I saw, and I started to cry. I picked up the phone, and I called. Not AA. I'm too cool for you. I called a different 12-step program. But that night, they didn't have anybody answering the phone, and an AA member had volunteered to help them. And he asked me if I'd meet him at a meeting, and I said I'd meet him at the meeting, and I went to the meeting. And I got tricked. It was an AA meeting. And I went into that meeting, and there was a lady speaking. It was this little Mexican lady, and her and I couldn't be any more different. She's a lady, I'm a guy. She's Mexican, I'm a little Jew guy. I'm little, she's really little, right? And she starts to share, and something happened that night that I heard Aura D from L.A. say this, and when she said it, I went back to that moment and remembered it. She said that the pain in her reached out and touched the pain in this other person. And we laugh a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous, but the laughter was not the first music I heard here because I couldn't hear that music. I heard the pain. I heard the tears. I heard the hurt. And her hurt reached out and touched my hurt, and I started to cry. And at the end of the meeting, I'm this blubbering idiot sitting in a chair, and I'm crying and weeping, and this guy comes up to me at the meeting, and he says, "Do you want to get sober?" And I think to myself, no. God, no, I don't want to get sober. That's the last thing I want to do. I got nothing in my life, nothing to live for, and nothing good. My life is over. I'm the kid with all the potential. I burned everything to the ground. My dad's not going to talk to me when he gets the credit card bill. My mom's already cut me off. I'm lonely and alone, and I got no friends and no good place to turn. I do not want to get sober. The only relief I've got left in this world, the only good there is that few minutes when I take that first hit. The promise of getting high is the only thing that is left in my life that is good. And do I want to give that up? No. That's not what I said. I said, yeah. Because I got nowhere to sleep that night, and I got no cigarettes, and I need some help, but here's a guy that's going to help me. I'm not going to say no. I go, yeah. And he says, "Are you willing to go to any lengths to get sober?" Which I thought was even goofier, you know. I went with this guy to a detox. Spent 7 days in a detox and 30 days in a halfway house. And I don't know if any of you have ever stayed in a halfway house. My experience in a halfway house when I first walked in that room was an amazing experience. Because I didn't think anybody was on my side or anybody was going to help me. I got no money. My clothes are dirty and I got no cigarettes. I got no food and I got no promise. I got no job. I can't help. And these guys took me in and said, "You don't got to pay no rent for 2 weeks. Go get a job." They fed me. They gave me quarters for the washing machine that was in that room, and they gave me cigarettes. And I thought, what a beautiful place. And 30 days later, I wanted to know who the hell they were telling me what time I had to be home. I'm a grown man, for God's sakes. I left that halfway house, and what started next was the worst 2 years, 2.5 years of my life. Because I had heard something in AA that I knew was true and I knew was about me and I knew that I belonged here and I would come to Alcoholics Anonymous and I would want to get sober. I need to get sober. I got to get sober. I mean, I can't keep living like I'm living. So I'm not going to drink and I don't drink. I'm not going to drink. I'm not going to drink. I'm just not going to drink. I'm not going to drink. And 10 days later, I drank. I'm not going to drink. I'm not going to drink. There's no way I'm not going to drink. And then I drink. People come to the podium of Alcoholics Anonymous and say what sounds to me like, "My name's Sheldon, I'm an alcoholic, I used to drink a lot, my life was crap, I don't drink no more, my life's great, thanks for letting me share it." I'm thinking, good for you. Because I am sober now, my life is not great, my life is more painful than it has ever been. I hate my life, I'm getting sober to get drunk, to get sober to get drunk, and I can't stand it. And I'm telling you, suicide is now a viable option for me, because I can't stand living the way I'm going to live, but I can't find a way out of this. I can't stop. Every time I think I got this thing licked, somehow something creeps up, and all of a sudden, boom, I'm drunk again, and I don't know how, and I don't know why. And I come to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and people say things to me that really hurt. And you want to hear something goofy? I say them today because I don't know what else to say. They say, "Are you done yet?" Am I done yet? You know what I want to say to that? Not from the podium. Not from the podium. You know what I want to say? "Are you ready? Am I ready? How ready you got to be? Am I ready?" Yeah, I'm ready. Because when I'm not drinking, something happens inside of me that I don't know how to control. And I got to get some relief from this because you know why? I'm not brave enough to put a gun in my mouth and squeeze the trigger. I don't know how to turn the wheel into the abutment of the freeway. And I can't stand living the way I'm living. So I'm going to drink again and I don't know why. Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous says there'll come a time in your life if you're an alcoholic where you can't imagine life without alcohol. That happened to me sometime around 9 years old. Then it says there'll be a time in your life where you can't imagine life with or without alcohol. You will be at the jumping off place and you will wish for the end. And the jumping off place ain't nothing but wishing you were dead. This is not a program of choosing not to drink or in a place where people are ready when they show up. I have no power in the choice of drink. When I get here, I have a disease that is trying to kill me, and that disease says drink whether you want to or not. And I'm dying when I get here, and I'm dying in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you're new and I've seen you coming in and out and I've said to you, you're ready, the reason I say that is because I don't know what else to say. I don't know how to invoke a miracle. I don't know how to do that. If I had the words to do that, I would do it, I promise. But I don't know how to do that. I don't know how to invoke a miracle, so I say to you something to make me feel safer. Are you ready yet? I don't know how to get sober. I don't know how to live. I don't know what to do. So I packed my things into a 1963 Volkswagen, and I drove to Las Vegas, and I moved here to open a beef jerky factory. You're laughing, but this is my life we're talking about. That's what I tell the family. I got a friend that's got a beef jerky recipe and another friend that's a marketing major at UNLV, and I'm a salesman of sorts, and the chef with the recipe is a fry cook at the Horseshoe, and the marketing genius drives a cab, and I haven't sold much for a while that's not measured in grams. But, you know, we got a dream, I move here and we move into this house together, and I never even tasted the beef jerky. I just got sober to get drunk to get sober to get drunk to get sober to get drunk to wish I was dead so my dad didn't have to watch me die. I don't have a friendly place to turn. I don't know what to do. July 4th, 1996, go back in my car and I go back to California to party with some friends for the 4th of July, and I take just about every chemical that I can get my hands on. And I should be able to get free, and I should be able to fly like I used to fly, but I can't fly no more. And I realize something that I always kind of knew, but I really get to know it now, that it's never going to be that way for me. That what's going to be for me is the way it's been for the last 3 years, and I'm slowly going to die until I fade away. And guys like me don't die fast. We linger. And when I die, there'll be no friendly people there. People that love me will still love me, but they'll be glad that I'm gone just because they can recover from me dying. They can't recover from me living, and I'm a broken guy. July 16th, 1996, I get on my knees and pray to a God I don't believe in, a prayer that I'd been praying for a while, and that was, God, if you exist, don't let me wake up tomorrow, because I can't, not like this, not like this, no more, and I can't get sober, and something in my head says to me, go to AA. And I don't know what that voice was. It could have been my subconscious. It could have been the memory of some crotchety old timer that says, keep coming back, when I was headed on my last run. But I like to believe because I'm hokey, and it's just what I like to believe. I like to believe that God was talking to me. And I came back to AA, and that was July 17th of 1996, and I walked into the Kiss Club more dead than alive. And I got hooked up with the group that was the precursor to this group. I got hooked up with the Floating Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Guys put their arm around me and said, Sheldon, if you want to get recovery, this is the way to go. And I didn't do it because I believed it would work. I didn't do it because I believed it would work. I did it simply because I had nowhere else to go. They were the only guys that wanted to talk to me. So I got in the car. Guys like Kevin and Louie that were there for me when I got sober. I got in the car. I met my sponsor, and my sponsor said to me, Sheldon, we got a series of steps in Alcoholics Anonymous, and if you'll take those steps, you'll get the relief you're looking for. And I didn't believe him. So sitting in his car on about the 20th of July, 3 or 4 days later, outside the Kenny Rogers, when it used to be there on Decatur and Alta, not on my knees, nothing fancy, we read the third step out of the book, and I said, I've done 1, 2, 3, drink too long. If that's all you got, I got to go. And he said, well, thankfully, it's not all we got. We got a fourth step. And he gave me the direction on writing the fourth step. And at 26 days sober, I shared my fifth step. I know, that's too fast. But as it was explained to me, not by my sponsor, but by my friend's sponsor, Sheldon, you're a dying man. You drown in Lake Mead. When do you want the life preserver? Do you want it now or do you want it a year from now? And I knew I couldn't tread water no more, so I took the life preserver and I started working those steps. And I did 4 and 5, and I shared my fifth step. And I'm going to very quickly give you some of the experience of my fifth step, because it was really an amazing turning point in my life. If you haven't done your fourth step, my experience is that it was great for me. I don't know what your experience will be. But when I did my fourth step, I thought mine was going to be different than everybody else's. I've since learned that they could have filled in the first few names for me, right? Dad, mom, you know, current spouse, employer, former spouse, former employer, and then gently whitter away to just about everybody I've ever made contact with, right? I didn't have the spouse, so mine was just mom, dad, employer, and all the rest of the family. And I hated my dad. My dad left when I was 2 years old. My dad was the first name on the list, and I hated him. I didn't just dislike him. I hated him. He left me when I was two, turned my life upside down. I wanted nothing to do with him. He abandoned me when I was 26 years old, and I was more dead than alive, and I didn't want anything to do with him. And we start talking about my dad, and my sponsor starts coming up with stuff about when he left that was the best he could do, but geez, it wasn't good enough. And he said that. He said, you know, your dad did the best for you that he could with the tools that he had. And I said, get new tools. I was two, for crying out loud. Get new tools. That's not good enough for me. I'm not interested in your psychological nonsense. I was 2 years old when that man left. He should have gotten new tools. And he ignored my dad, and he said, let's move on to your mom. We talked about my mom. My mom was difficult to live with. I told you my mom went to Al-Anon, and she took some meds until she felt better. That's the difference between alcoholics and non-alcoholics. Non-alcoholics stop taking the meds when they feel better. But she started taking the meds. She took taking the meds. She felt better. She goes to Al-Anon. She's a different woman now. But when I was growing up, she was a screamer and a yeller, and she'd say nasty, painful, hurtful things. She'd say to me things like, your father ruined my life, and you're just like that son of a bitch. And he really hurt me. And I hated my mom. And my sponsor started talking about the fact that, well, do you think your mom's got a disease of any kind? I said, well, I know she does. Because since then, she's become a different person. She's been to some doctors, got some help. She's not like that anymore. He said, well, the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous said that perhaps the people who harmed us, like ourselves, are sick too. And Sheldon, you probably did some things when you were out there that hurt some people that, you know, you're not really, you did it because of a disease. And you probably want some forgiveness for that, because after all, you're not a bad guy trying to get good. You're a sick guy trying to get well. And I said, that's right. He said, and you're not guilty for a lot of those things you did out there. You're responsible, and you will clean them up. And we have a step for that. But you're not guilty. But if you want that forgiveness, you have to be willing to give it. And you have to be willing to give the people who were sick some forgiveness, too. He said, your mom's got a disease just like your disease. And I didn't instantly forgive my mom. And it wasn't like I love her now right away. But what happened was I got to get some understanding of what my mom may have been going through. And understanding is what step four and five are all about. By understanding what she struggled with, I was able to let her off the hook a little bit. And in 11 years, we've been able to get a relationship now where I'm more like a son. And she is more like a mom than she has ever been to me today. More like that than she's ever been to me today. And I start to let my mom off the hook. So my sponsor says, what about your dad? I said, I thought we were done with him. He says, well, what do you think it was like for your dad living with your mom? I said, what do you mean? He said, do you think your mom got sick after he left, or do you think she was always sick? I said, I don't know. He said, precisely. He said, is it possible? Not likely, not definite, but possible. Is it possible that just like the case you have built up, that you are certain about what was going through your dad's mind when you were 2 years old? Is it possible that he married your mom as they did in that little Jewish community all those years ago before he knew what she was like? And is it possible she got pregnant with your older brother before he knew what she was like? But he stayed as long as he could because she was pregnant with a small child, and he figured out he was in a bad place and it was going to be hard for him, but he stayed as long as he could. And he's getting ready to leave because now your brother's 2 years old, and she can probably cope if he just sends money, but she gets pregnant with you. So he stays. He stays as long as he can till he can't stay no more. And then when he leaves, he doesn't leave to live next door like you wanted him to. Because if it had done that, they'd have asked him why he left. They'd have had to have defend himself and defend his dignity. So he'd have had to tell him it's because she's crazy. So to defend her dignity, is it possible, not likely, not probable, but possible that he left town and then the country so he could be the bad guy, not have to defend himself and she could keep her dignity? Is it possible? Yeah. Sheldon, what would you have done if you were your dad? That's not fair. What would I have done? When I was 16 years old, I became an emancipated adult. I went down to the housing authority in England, and I told them my mom threw me out. I wiped mud on my face and packed some dirty clothes in a backpack and told them I was homeless. And because I was 16, they wouldn't put me in any kind of foster care. They gave me money. They set me up in my own little house, and they made me a welfare guy. And I did that because I couldn't stand living with my mother. And when that wouldn't work and I kept spending my welfare check, the first day it got there on dope and on booze. And I was starving for the next 12 days, 13 days. I got on a plane and came to live with my dad. And even though I hated him, I came to live with him because I couldn't stand to live with her. What would I have done if I was my dad? I tell you something. When she got pregnant with my older brother, I'd have said, you got to be out of your mind. I'm gone. And you'd have a different speaker tonight. Is it possible? I don't know. Sheldon, if you can be wrong about that, Sheldon, if you can be wrong about the very thing that you have built the foundation of your life on, if you can be wrong about the very thing that you have built your entire existence around, what else could you be wrong about? Boy, I can be wrong about a lot. I can be wrong about a lot. I've learned the lessons in Alcoholics Anonymous that have made me not a perfect guy. I make a lot of mistakes. But I tell you something that's funny. That guy that looked himself in the eye in that hotel room all those years ago when my eyes met his eyes, that broken person of whom I was ashamed didn't come here to speak to you tonight. When I look myself in the mirror today, what I see a very good child, a good son. My father could have gone anywhere in the world when he retired. He retired to Las Vegas. My mom could have gone anywhere in the world when she and her husband retired. They retired to Las Vegas. They didn't retire to live near me. I have their only grandchild. But I tell you, the old me would have kept them away. The old me would have stolen their grandchild from them and my grandparents from my son. The old me would have destroyed that family, and Alcoholics Anonymous put that family back together. When I was 5 years sober, I get a phone call from my brother in England, and my brother's just had an epileptic seizure brought on by a heroin overdose, and he's been thrown out by all the family everywhere in England. He's got nowhere to go. People in Alcoholics Anonymous tell me, Sheldon, you can't bring him here. You can't bring him here. You can't help him. My sponsor says, Sheldon, you got to fly him out here. Buy him a ticket and get him here. Because he's going to die, Sheldon. He's going to die. Two brothers getting sober in Alcoholics Anonymous is a very rare thing. He's going to die. But when he does, you need to look your mother in the eye and say, Mommy, I tried to help your oldest son. You need to be able to do that. So I brought him out here. I brought him to Vegas, and then he moved to California. My brother's 6 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I haven't talked much about God in my talk, and I'll tell you why that is. It is because although I have a very, very strong connection with the God that I believe in, and that God has changed my world completely, I am very, very, very spiritually naive. I struggle every day with my relationship with a God that I completely misunderstand. But let me tell you, Alcoholics Anonymous has brought a God into my life, and it has done the very opposite of the thing that I did. I destroyed my family. Alcoholics Anonymous repairs families. My mom and my dad and my brother and myself all have much enriched lives because of Alcoholics Anonymous. The only thing that I would ask anybody who is new to do is to do what my brother promised me he would do when I picked him up from the airport and we're driving home. And I said, Sheldon, I said, Jason, what are you going to do? He said, Sheldon, I don't know. And I said, that's a start. He said, Sheldon, I promise you this. I will suspend my right to have an opinion, and I will do what your friends in AA tell me to do. And what I ask anybody that is new to do is to do what my brother, at 1 or 2 days of sobriety, told me when I thought I was going to help him, and when he, in fact, helped me more. And he said to me, Sheldon, I'm going to suspend my right to have an opinion and do what your friends in AA tell you to do. And I implore the newcomer to suspend your right to have an opinion and do what your friends in AA tell you to do. Because if you will do that, I can't promise you your life will turn out like mine. But I can promise you that if you will do Alcoholics Anonymous as if your life depends on it, if you will do Alcoholics Anonymous like the dying, if you will do this like you are a last grasper, if you will do this like there is no other way to turn, if you will do that, I promise you that your life will get better. And if you don't, I can promise you this. Mine won't get any worse. I'm not here to sell you anything. I'm not here because if you get sober, I get a toaster. I'm here to share with you the thing that was given to me, the thing that is precious. And that is the idea that should you suffer from alcoholism, Alcoholics Anonymous can be a solution. I hope that if you knew, you suspend your right to have an opinion and you do what your friends at Alcoholics Anonymous tell you. It's been an honor to speak to my home group. Thank you.